Welcome. Thank you for coming to hear Julian speak tonight. We're very excited to have all of you here, and we at the Redeemer Presbyterian Church Financial Services Ministry are delighted to have Julian participate and share his wisdom and insights with us. My name is Jensen Ko. I'm one of the leaders in the Financial Services Ministry, and our mission is to equip, connect, and mobilize professionals in financial services to see our professional work itself as a sacred calling and to strive for common goods of the industry. So, for example, whether you are investment banker or executive assistant or auditor or even hedge fund manager, we feel that there is a reason why you are where you are at work. And basically, realizing that this is not an accident, working together, we pursue opportunities to serve our industry and the greater community. Some of the examples of what we've been doing is, for example, setting up events like this where we have industry leaders like Julian sharing his insights with us. We also do work related to nonprofits where we gather a group of people like-minded to help them use their skill sets to help the organizations with financial planning and other assistance. And also something as simple as just praying for your colleagues at workplace, especially someone who's struggling and not doing well who are sitting right next to you. And if you have any other questions about our ministry, our group, I encourage you to check out our website, which is www.faithandwork.org. And you're welcome to ask me or any of other Redeemerites here for questions and comments. Now, off to Julian. Given our desire to serve and really have an impact in the world, we're just delighted to have someone of Julian's caliber to share his evening with us. If we can summarize Julian's accomplishments at Tiger in just two words, it would be absolutely fabulous. From 1980 to 1999, when he closed the fund, Tiger's assets grew from 8.8 million to close to 25 billion. In addition, Tiger's compounded annual return for partners during its existence, net of all fees, was 31.7%. Clearly, Julian showed new path to his investors, and still, he's making them make their lives better through investing. However, what's very interesting is that the ripple effect that Julian generated does not stop there. In fact, it's not even close. In fact, what Julian has been doing in the areas of philanthropy and people development, I believe, and we all believe, overshadow even the 31.7% annual return he was producing at his day job. And it's this ripple effect that we want to honor tonight. And I want to give you a little more color of his accomplishments in this regard by sharing you the story of Tiger Cubs and Tiger Foundation. First, Tiger Cubs. Julian may be the best teacher of investing that we've ever had. Just a couple years ago, market observers noted that 20% of assets going into the long-short equity strategy was from Tiger Cubs, i.e. ex-employees of Tiger. These Cubs are now the leaders of the financial services hedge fund industry, and collectively, they're having an enormous impact on the way money is managed in the industry. Another industry expert just recently said, given the history of Wall Street, and there are very few firms that were able to produce many good talent, Tiger certainly stands out as an exception in that people who came out of Tiger were head and shoulders above the rest, and the fact that investors knew that the type of training and experience that they got from Julian is invaluable certainly makes Tiger one of the unique organizations. Julian's passion to source, retain, and inspire talents in the money management world will be a lasting legacy. Secondly, I'd like to talk to you about Tiger Foundation. Tiger Foundation was launched in 1990 with the goal of assisting nonprofit organizations who serve the neediest families in New York City. However, there was another agenda for Tiger Foundation, and that is to recommend and look for ways to have an informed philanthropy for the investment department at Tiger's staff who are working in there. And one of the things that is unique about this foundation is that participating employees not only put their personal financial resources, but they also serve in the capacity of trustees and actually actively engage in the grant-making decisions, which is very unique. Catherine, who's leading our Center for Faith and Work initiative at Redeemer, and I had a chance to speak to Phoebe Boyer, who is an executive director at the Tiger Foundation, and she'd mentioned that the foundation operates on only 2 or 3 full-time staff. And the reason being is that you have 25 trustees, all Tiger Cubs, basically actively engaged in grant-making process and doing the heavy lifting for the foundation. So just imagine this. Imagine these trustees getting together to talk about grant-making decisions, and you better watch out. The battle-tested teeth and claws of Tiger Days are in full action as they duke it out to find the best investing opportunities for their foundation. And sometimes I hear that the conversations become so heated that it reminds of the days of running Tiger. And there's a lengthy waiting list of Tiger Cubs who want to join and duke it out with them in future. Julian's passion to motivate, teach, and inspire highly talented money managers to really care about the world will perhaps be his most lasting legacy. Now that you've heard about Julian's passion for instilling excellence in investing and philanthropy, you might be wondering, well, he might be able to return 31.7% in stock market, but what about his return from philanthropy? What was his ROI, return on investment? I'm glad you asked. Let me share with you an example from Julian's relationship with Cancer Research Institute. Cancer Research Institute, also known as CRI, is a 501c3 nonprofit organization founded in 1953 to foster the science of cancer immunology. So what that means is that using our natural immune system to fight cancer. This effort back in 1953 when it began was not one of a popular initiative. In fact, there was a lot of naysayers. And CRI really helped to pioneer and develop this new way of looking at cancer treatment, and has now been recognized throughout the world as offering great hope for the ultimate prevention and treatment of human cancer. Julian was and has been a longtime trustee and one of its most influential supporters. I was privileged to attend CRI's recent benefit dinner honoring Julian, and I recall Dr. Lloyd Old, the director of the institute, expressing deep gratitude for Julian's 36 years of unsurpassed dedication and commitment to this cause. With his voice quivering, his emotions all out, he basically said, "When I started this with a co-founder and the vision was first introduced, no one took him and his co-founder seriously. And without Julian's personal commitment to this cause, there would have been no Cancer Research Institute and there would be no vaccine for cervical cancer, which was approved by federal drug officials this June." Ending his remarkable confession, Dr. Old said, "Julian provided us with the confidence to persevere in the face of what really were formidable obstacles." That's a return on investment I think any investor would be proud to have. Tonight, we honor Julian's passion for inspiring excellence in investing and philanthropy, and also his commitment to instill the same kind of passion to second and third generations of money management professionals. By turning his passions into action, Julian has created a powerful ripple effect, and indeed, he has changed the world. We're grateful to have him with us this evening, delighted to have all of you be able to meet him and ask him questions, and we hope we have a great time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jensen. I really appreciate that introduction. I didn't recognize the person you were talking about, but I appreciated it very much anyway. It is an honor to be in front of this group, which has probably done more to promote the Christian religion and been more successful in doing it than any other group in the world. And it is just fabulous to see what you've done, what you are doing, and I will come any time that I can work with you all on anything, because I know what you're doing is so successful. And it's so very, very important. And I think that the traditional churches have not carried their weight. And it's just great to see an organization like this one pick up the slack and really carry it on, and it's so very, very important. And I want to tell you, it's an honor to see 200 or so people that are so very, very dedicated and have been so successfully dedicated as all of you. I've given a number of these talks, and oftentimes I put my best foot forward and work for weeks on the speech, and I look out and three quarters of the room is asleep. And I was just remembering once in North Carolina, I went back to my home state, and my son, who was graduating from college, introduced me, and he was fabulous. I mean, people were laughing, cheering, and practically all he said was, look, I don't know why I'm here, but I'm so glad I am here because I just graduated from college. Here's my resume, and could anybody give me a job? And the people just loved that. I thought it was just going to be duck soup to wow this crowd. And sure enough, the same old thing came up. They were asleep. And my sister told me later, said, you know, they didn't want to hear all your dark thoughts on the economy. They wanted to hear about how tough the Tar Heel football team was going to be and how they were going to be the national champions in basketball, and that's what you should have talked about. So I don't know what you want to talk about, and I think the best way to find that out is to give you the opportunity to ask me questions, and I will try to respond to them. But it's a great honor to be with you, and I'm looking forward to talking with you and trying to answer any questions you've got. So we'll lead off. Yes, sir.
My question is when you were making a lot of money and having stellar returns, how did you keep a level head and just a humble perspective?
Usually you get to repeat the question, so while you're thinking of an answer to something, but you foil that plan of attack by giving the microphone out. Well, I've always looked at investing and money management as a game, and it's been one that I've thoroughly enjoyed. And I think we are so lucky to be in a profession where most of us would be happy practicing the trade at an average wage instead of the kind of monies that we do make. But I think I grew up in a home where money was not the most important thing around, and I think that most of the people I've worked with have kept very level heads too. And but thank you for saying that I did. Probably a better answer would be it wouldn't be level except I've lost all my hair. But any rate, I think it is very important to keep a level head. And I notice that sometimes people who remain bachelors for even longer than I did get an unlevel head, and I think it's maybe because they don't have a wife to say, you know, look, just get off your high horse and get down here with the rest of us where you belong. And I think that is important to do.
I actually have a question for you, Julian. I read in one of your speeches that you gave to business schools that you felt that there was a high correlation between highly talented money managers and their caring for the world. And that was very interesting to note. And I wanted to ask you, which one's harder, inspiring someone to become a hedge fund manager successfully or to inspiring them to become a great philanthropist?
Well, I've gotten a lot of credit for teaching people to be great hedge fund managers. And I'm not being falsely modest about that. I really think we hired wonderful people. And I'm very proud that we hired wonderful people. And I'm very sure that the people we hired would have been great hedge fund managers with or without me. But obviously, it's very important for them to be good hedge fund managers because they can be much more effective philanthropists if they're successful than if they're slaving around and having a real tough time with it. Yes, sir.
This is a two-part question. The first part is, can you just sketch out your path to Wall Street? Because it started down in North Carolina and ended up with an incredible run. And then part two, given that this organization really does study and try to put faith and work together, how did you find faith and work intersecting for you over the course of your many years on Wall Street?
I think I was very lucky that my father was actually in the textile business, but he loved stocks. And I actually had an aunt who loved stocks. And I remember when I was about 6 years old, seeing her look at the financial page of a paper. And I said, what are you doing looking at that strange sheet of paper there? And she told me she was looking up the price of a stock. And I remember it to this day. The name of the company was United Corporation. It was about a $3 stock. But any rate, my father was a very good teacher, and we spent a lot of nights on the floor looking at stock tables, and it gave me a real lead up when I went to college, and it was very important to me. And I think likewise, my parents were active Christians and active leaders in the community. And it was just something that sort of was instilled, sort of as part of life when I was growing up. I was very fortunate on that. Very fortunate.
Hi, two-part question again. Just in terms of your investing framework, could you share a little bit, what are the key topics? And then also maybe spend a little bit of time talking about the environment at Tiger that produced the kind of, the managers that brought up that sort of legendary teaching environment. What was it?
I think that we got a lot of really great people. Because we were lucky enough to get some really good young people early on. Those young people made a great name for themselves. They went out and became well-known while being at Tiger, and they became a kind of move towards Tiger by good young people. And I think to our credit, we realized that good young people could be really wonderful managers, and we gave them the ball and let them run with it. And probably they couldn't have run as far and as fast anywhere else as we gave them the reins to do. And that gradually brought in a succession of good young people, which still continues today at Tiger. I mean, I think most people think that Tiger shut down in the early 2000s, but our focus has changed. We are now what we're doing is working with new funds, and those people run their own funds, it's their decisions, it's their record, all of that. But that's what we're doing now, and I think in essence the strength of Tiger then and the strength of the new people who are working at Tiger, and many of whom have adopted Tiger in the names of their funds, that the common denominator that made them so successful was good young people following good young people, really. All of them smarter than the first guy who was in the door.
And then in regards to an investment framework, how you thought about investing, buying equities?
Well, I think in terms of investing, that's sort of hard to do in a sentence. But I would say that that a good team working together effectively is the way really good results come out. Now, there are exceptions to that. There were a number of really geniuses around who kind of did it on their own genius. Not having been given that, I had to depend on the people around. And I think most of the people at our shop now have teams rather than individual efforts. And they, I really judge a fund for the long term on the basis of the teams that they put together. And I think I can kind of tell a little bit about who's going to be really successful in this business when I see what kind of teams they assemble. Boy, was that a way, roundabout way to answer a question.
Thank you very much for coming this evening. As a former compliance officer for a Wall Street brokerage firm in prime brokerage, how do you keep not only your employees, but the brokerage firms and the employees there in line in terms of keeping a moral balance because and ethically doing things correctly? Because the temptation to fudge something, numbers, and or any kind of trading, front running or whatever, how do you prevent that? How do you keep them straight?
I would say we don't keep them straight. They keep themselves straight. And we, I think, do it through our hiring practices. We put people through a pretty intensive test when they come to work with us. And I'd say that the most important thing on that test is personal integrity. And it really shows that very well. And we started the test because we actually hired some people who just didn't have the firepower to do the job. And that's really hard to do when you just have to let someone go because they, not because they didn't try hard, but because they just didn't have the firepower. But we worked with some testers, and it's far more far-reaching than just the firepower. So we really think we can, you know, do a pretty good job of hiring honest people. And I think everybody at our shop knows that we definitely err on the side of we want to be right in the high road all the way. And I think people know that. And I mean, I don't think a lot of people pay a lot of attention to insider information and all of that, and we do. I mean, there's been any number of times when I've asked people, look, you know that, but is that inside information? And I will admit, on insider information, that's such a difficult thing to decipher what is and what isn't. That I think, but where there's a question, we just don't use it.
Then, sort of the second part of that was, how do you then make sure that the firms that you hire, brokerage firms or any kind of outsourcing, follow the ethical standards that you have at your shop?
I don't think they do. I mean, I shouldn't say, I don't think they all do. It's really what I should have said.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is somewhat related to an earlier question. Your ability to pick human talent is as legendary as your ability to pick stocks. I think by the Tiger Cubs community, that's pretty obvious. But when you first meet a potential analyst that wants to work for you, what are the qualities that really matter to you that you think are pretty important? And once they do come work for you as an analyst, what qualities do you look at in an analyst that would give you the confidence that they're going to become a great money manager after that?
Well, I think that the qualities we look for, I think really we depend a lot on these tests and what we can find about these people from other people. A lot of the people that come to work with us are friendly with other young people who have gone through our program, and they vouch for them, and that means an awful lot. But it's been very interesting. We have found that that the best analysts are, one, their integrity is without question. Two, they're generally very interested in sports, and many of them are good athletes. They're very competitive. And I think our people, when Tiger was going, would have delightedly given up 10 or 15% of their pay for us to have been in a higher percentile so that we would we would beat out the other firms in terms of performance. They are very conscious of that, and I think that's an important factor to have. We also have found that most of these money managers have a tendency to really want to change the world. I mean, I think that's why, for instance, the Robin Hood affairs raise so much money. I mean, these things, I mean, there's no charities in New York that raise that kind of money in an entire year. And that's primarily a hedge fund group of people at a party one night raising money for various charities in New York, and they raise a huge amount of money at those things. And so I think the proof is in a lot of ways that people that are good in the hedge fund business are really interested in changing things. I mean, I didn't know there were 100 women in hedge funds. I mean, and then there are not only 100 women in hedge funds, but there are 100 women in hedge funds that are out raising money like crazy for good charities to give that money to.
Well, you've done a great job of describing the business side. I'd like to ask about the philanthropic side. And my question is, how do you pick what you're going to give your money to? And I can picture that you did so well with leveraging your money in the hedge fund. You did so well with picking people. And so when you cross, and you didn't ask God, I gather, but when you cross over to the philanthropic side, you can ask God. I wonder whether you do. And do you invest in philanthropically in things that pull at your heartstrings? Or do you look for places where your money is going to be highly leveraged, or do you count on the people and go after the people? And I ask these questions so I'll know what to put in the letter I'm going to write you.
Well, there were a lot of questions in there, and I'll try to kind of remember it. But on the philanthropic side, I've just had a lot of recent exposure to the Tiger Foundation, which, as you've heard already tonight, was founded to help underprivileged families in New York, but also to encourage the young analysts at our place to be philanthropists. And it really has worked really well, and I think probably, I said this last night, is the thing I'm proudest of that I've been involved with. And the Tiger Foundation uses the leverage. And there, the trustees of the organization who are workers at the firm, I mean, they used to be all employees of Tiger. Now they're either ex-employees of Tiger or they're employees that of funds that Tiger seeds. And they are the trustees of the foundation. They not only grant the money to these various entities, but they go out and they are on the boards of those entities, and they are helping the management of those charities run their charities in a very business-like function. And I think this system is one that should be replicated in organizations where there are really competent people working and where people have confidence in one another. And I think there is tremendous leverage in that system of letting the trustees or encouraging the trustees to go out and really work with the organizations that they fund.
So what I hear you saying is you're investing in the people, but you also make investments on your...
I definitely believe in that. And I also, I'm encouraged to invest with people whom I have a lot of confidence in. It does no good to invest in a cause if the person in charge isn't effective. And for instance, as soon as I got into the philanthropic business, I had very little interest in the environment. But I mean, next to God, I mean, the environment is about all we've got in the final analysis. And so you can't really be philanthropic unless you consider the environment. And we ran into a wonderful fellow who ran a wonderful organization, and he's really carried the ball for us. And we financed him, well, to a limited degree. I mean, he gets a lot of other stuff too, but we've worked really well together. I mean, he talks the language of what we're talking about. He called one day and said, Julian, I've got the greatest speculation you can imagine. We have the chairman of the Senate in California who will keep the Senate open until we get the votes for the strictest emission bill ever put forward. And anyway, we got some lobbyists in there and got some friends in there, and they went to work on the Senate, and we got this bill passed, and it's a huge thing. I mean, now the Northeast is trying to get into it. But Governor Schwarzenegger signed that act a couple of weeks ago, and it was for a very little bit of money. I think we really got it passed. I mean, we helped get it passed. I mean, God got it passed, but we helped get it passed, and it was a great, great feeling.
Well, thank you very much. It'll be interesting to see how you grade my letter.
Well, I'm terrified to get it. Feel like that's going to be very expensive, and Bill, your results even have to get better.
I just had one
question.
Here's
a kiwi. I'm thrilled about this. I'm kind of a would-be Kiwi. Our family have gotten very interested in New Zealand, and I'm really thrilled to see a kindred spirit here.
Good to hear. My question is not about New Zealand, but but it is about the church, and specifically, you made a comment at the beginning that you thought that this organization had done a fantastic job of being effective in the city and really just working, I guess, productively. My one question is, have you ever seen an example where the church has leveraged the power of compounding annual returns? And if not, do you think there's room for it to appreciate it?
Give me that again. I didn't quite get that.
Sure. Have you ever seen an example where the church has appreciated the power of compounding annual returns? And if not, do you think there's a room for them to appreciate it?
Well, I hope that every church is a good steward of its funds. And I hope they will appreciate compounding their funds. They can certainly do more good with more funds. And I think it's important that any organization be good stewards of the capital it has to work with.
Do you think there's room for sort of greater, I guess, union between the powers that are in money management to grow returns at incredible rates and sort of the impact of the church?
I'm not quite sure. I am not one of these people that I saw on the front of Time not long ago. God wants us all to be rich. I'm not at all sure of that, and I think some of the things in the Bible would almost argue otherwise. I don't know whether that's an answer to the question or not. But as far as the church's funds are concerned, I think it's important that they manage them as effectively as they possibly can.
Okay, thanks.
Sort of a similar question, but more from a personal perspective. I know a lot of people, especially in New York City, make a lot of money. And the question is, at what point, there's not really the right answer, but I guess some of your thoughts would be great on this, but at what point, and the Bible says the tithe 10%, but then there's also, you know, everything we have, we're supposed to be God's stewards. So at what point, like, what are the thoughts that go through your head when you're looking, how much should I save, you know, invest, make more capital, and then I can give more away later, or how much do I really need to give away now? You know, you become worth so much at some point, do you need to give everything you make away? Or, like, what are just some of the thoughts that you can give us, you know, as we're growing up? A lot of the people in the room are real young, and as we make more money, you know, what are some of the thoughts we should be thinking about to identify how much we should really be giving away and how much we should be saving?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And, of course, you can't give a finite answer to that question, but I think you have to look at some of the things that have happened. Now, if Warren Buffett had given away everything he had every year while he was going, he wouldn't have had the $30 billion to give to the Gates Foundation, which I incidentally think is one of the great things that's been done, and very much like what Warren Buffett would do. In other words, he found really good people that he's investing with, and he's going with the Gates. I think it will do an enormous amount of good. I mean, and the Gates group. We work with them with the New York City schools. We know about their work in Africa. I mean, they are just a beautifully organized operation. So for those who think, you know, to give it all away instantaneously, I think that the Warren Buffett situation would be a counter-argument. I think that's personal with people, and that people are going to have to kind of come to their own conclusions on that. I think in my case, I'm leaving most to a foundation, so it's a little bit of a catch-all. So hopefully the money will be, you know, well spent in the future, but it will be, you know, primarily given to things that are doing things for mankind. And I mean, it's a little bit of a cop-out doing it, but that's, I do think that's, you know, everybody has to wrestle with that question themselves and come up with the answer that's best for them.
Hi, I actually wanted to continue on the same line of discussion about philanthropy. And as a church in New York City, one of our goals is to break the cycle of poverty in the city, which is very much akin to Tiger Foundation. And recently we've drawn a lot of inspiration and have worked with people who've been in the Tiger Foundation and to kind of give us some ideas on how to go about doing that. I actually wanted to ask you about what you saw as the role of faith-based organizations like ourselves in the community and how faith can work in the development and helping out our local communities.
Well, I think that so many faith-based initiatives are not providing people with the opportunities to do things for disadvantaged youth or disadvantaged people. I mean, I really think that a lot of people are crying out to be helpful. Old people, young people, everybody would like to be helpful. And I think that faith-based initiatives should, I think it helps their own growth if they have an organized program of outreach. And it's just like the trustees of the Tiger Foundation. If this assembled group here, when it goes out to the various charities it helps, the more it gets involved in the charities directly, the more they are going to benefit, and in many instances, probably more with the effort than with the money. Hi.
Hi, Julian. I just want to continue on the theme of stewardship. Just touching on someone's question earlier about the fact that there's a lot of, you know, younger people in the audience today. I have a hard time believing that you just woke up one day and decided to give away millions of dollars to the various organizations that that you're involved in philanthropically. So I was wondering if you could give us some guidelines in terms of disciplines. You know, you mentioned your family and just how they had a strong focus on giving back to their local communities. What along the way during your career did you think about practically to help you kind of keep yourself in check as you are making more and more money? Are there any resources or bits of advice that you remember that you can share with us?
Well, I mean, you know, that assumes that I've done a great job of it. I mean, there might be a lot of people in this room would say, well, he's a cheapskate on this. He should have given a lot more. And I mean, I think that's a very personal thing. I don't know, you know, you can't, there are certain things that you've got to make your own decisions on, and I really honestly believe that this is one of those things. I think it's similar to the decision of whether you believe in God or not. I mean, I think no one else can make that for you, and I don't think anybody else can sort of tell you how to give. And I think they're, you know, the person who gives every bit of his money, I mean, I think that's wonderful. And I think, you know, there are examples like Warren Buffett who are fabulous as well.
Thank you.
So there's avoiding the issue again, but anyway.
I recently came across an investment opportunity where I thought the management had a pretty good track record of creating value for shareholders, and I thought it was a compelling investment opportunity. I had also had no reason to disbelieve the management. I felt like the management realized that by being dishonest with investors, that would be acting against their own interests. So I felt that they were honest in what they told me about the company and their business plans. But on a personal note, in checking references, I found out that the CEO was perhaps, he liked to live life in the fast lane, or he liked to frequent strip clubs, or wasn't faithful to his wife. Would you let that personal view of morality influence your investment decision? But if you believe that he was otherwise honest in his business dealings?
Well, I mean, you know, I think that anybody that cheats on his wife is a cheater. And I mean, there could be enough otherwise in the company that would overwhelm you into investing in it, but he's a cheater. And I don't feel quite the same way about a strip club, but I mean, he is a cheater, and the worst kind of cheater.
Well, I think it was a strip club, so he wasn't. Well, so. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi. First, I really want to thank you because I worked at some areas with Robin Hood Foundation, and in the past annual dinner, you were very modest, and you didn't want to disclose, but you raised over $32 million, and I don't think that there is any foundation that raises that amount of money in 1 year. So my congratulations and bravo. But now on another note, it's more about the investments and not the morality. I just want to ask you, what are your views about, we've got, when you started, there were very few, there were just maybe 200 or 300 hedge funds. Right now you have over 8,000. A lot of hedge fund managers have a terrible, arrogant attitude. There is a lot of consolidation. And look at Amerant, which recently just, fell on the face. What are your views about what's going on currently within the hedge fund industry? Because I do think it has changed tremendously. So I would like to hear about you.
Well, I think that the Amaranth thing is perfectly normal. I mean, I think, you know, that's part of business. There are people that have problems, and they've had one. I think there are going to be more of these things in the future. I mean, I don't think we'll ever, you know, have a perfect system. Some of the best investors have fallen. Meriwether is the man that I
the long-term capital.
I mean, he's somebody I admire quite a bit, and he, you know, had his problem and he's come back, but. I mean, there are always going to be failures in the hedge fund business. I don't think there's any question about it. Now, I agree with you that when we started, there were very few. There weren't hundreds. There were probably, I've often said this. I thought when Tiger started in about 1980, I would be willing to bet that if you really looked it up, there was less than $1 billion in the hedge fund industry.
Yeah, there are about 200.
And, you just think of the growth that's occurred.
Yeah.
Now well over $1 trillion. And so I do think people speak with a lot of authority who have had the good fortune to be in hedge funds. It's one of the reasons why I don't particularly like to go to a lot of the hedge fund meetings now, because people do seem, in many instances, to have let this go to their head.
Right.
I think, which is just unfortunate. But I think that people with that kind of attitude will get knocked around, and they'll be knocked around, and probably have to regroup.
Right.
But I don't think that amaranth is enough to cause anybody's concern over the health of the hedge fund industry, because it's still the best way to run money, and it's the way to attract the best managers, and there's just no way of arguing that, and I think it will keep being the best.
This was just one. There were many more than amaranth, but that was the most recent one. Of course, you know.
But there always have been those that have had,
had problems. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. Well, to end the first half with a fun question, I love art, the arts, and I know you have a big collection of Matisse and Cezanne and Picasso, and just, I just wondered what your latest acquisition was and why.
Well, that's a lovely question to ask, and the latest acquisition that I really love is a Fauve d'Arrain, it is a beautiful picture with, it's a landscape with a lot of pinks and bold colors in it, and it's really gorgeous. And I got it at an auction last spring, and it's my favorite thing we've got in the art world. Okay, Patrick Prell, a workmate, and. Don't make this too tough.
No, Hans Orm and others had always described to me with great admiration your ability to, as he used to call it, gun a position. You know, you'd be up 25%, and instead of taking money off the table, you knew when to gun it and when to not gun it. You know, what were the disciplines that you imposed, or was it just Bob Fink telling you to back off? What were the disciplines that you imposed upon yourself, and how did you know when to gun it and when to get out of a position?
Well, again, that's a really long-winded answer, and I guess the answer really is I didn't. But if you have a big position and you suddenly find out that things are going better than you ever thought, you can gun it. And we are involved in a company called Ryanair, and they are the lowest cost airline in the world, and they're just eating up the competition, and we've kind of gunned that position a lot recently, but if you gun it and it works, you got to ungun it. So we'll probably be ungunning some soon. I think you set up certain parameters, and you don't want to go beyond those, and you just can't afford to not discipline yourself on certain parameters, particularly on diversification. And no matter what happens, you've got to follow those dictates. If everything is going better than you think, sometimes it works to gun it for a while.
Two other real quick ones. You know, you're legendary for being a stock picker, but yet you manage one of the most successful macro funds. In the long term, what did you make more money off of, stock picks or asset allocation?
I think we were a lot better in stock picks.
Okay. And what were the three worst picks that you ever made? And what were you thinking at the time?
Well, the biggest mistake that I think I ever made relates to your first question about gunning things. We had gunned our position in U.S. Air. And U.S. Air was selling around $80 a share. And I called the president of U.S. Air, and I said, look, you know, I love what you've done for us, but it's time for us to sell some stock. We just have too much of it. Would you be interested in, you know, would you be willing to buy some? And he said, sure, we'll buy every share you have and a lot more. But he said, you know, you've been a good friend. You can hold on if you want to. And I said, I'll hold. And it was probably to go down as the worst mistake I ever made. You've got to hold your disciplines.
Hi, Mr. Robertson. My question is, if you were starting Tiger today in the current environment that's out there, and you know, you weren't managing $20 billion, but you were managing, you know, 10 or 20 million like you were in the beginning, and you could pick any way you wanted to start it. So you could pick any strategy, long, short, arbitrage, distressed debt, you know, whatever strategy you want. You could do it in any country. So you could invest in Japanese stocks or U.S. stocks or Asian stocks or European stocks. Or, you know, something else, how would you go about it? And, you know, what would be the things that you would focus on in the beginning?
I would go long, short, and I wouldn't put any bounds on it. Why limit yourself to any one country or any one area? There are good longs and good shorts everywhere, and you really shouldn't limit yourself on a geographic basis. So I would just have an open long short fund. I really would.
Hello, sir. Something you said actually at the beginning, just like in the opening remarks, was interesting to me. You're commending the group for being like more effective than you said, like traditional churches in the city. I've only been in New York for like a couple of years and part of Redeemer for a couple of years, but I was just wondering if you could flesh that out. Like, what do you mean when you say been more sort of, you know, if effective in reaching people with our faith, or have you seen that in this community?
Well, I think your growth dwarfs that of anybody else, and I'm really talking in terms of numbers, but because I can measure that, but I would also say in terms of enthusiasm. In terms of, this is not a good word, but proselyting, all of those things, I'd say, you know, you all had been the most successful.
And just kind of quick follow-up.
You could probably argue me down on that, but I really believe it.
And that's much appreciated, I mean, even just having been here for a couple of years. But what's one thing that you think, even as a group of young folks in the in the city of this church, that we can even do better than we are now in terms of reaching people, you know, with our faith and helping our community?
Well, I'm sure that if I were closer involved, I could find something to criticize. But basically, I think you're doing a darn good job, and I would just say keep up the good work. And I think it shows up so well because I think the establishment churches aren't doing such a good job.
Thank you very much. I was wondering if you could expand a little more on some of the other mistakes that you've made, just so, you know, we can learn from your own learnings, right? Because you've been so successful, and I think that's the most instructive for us.
Well, I think that's the most important thing, because you're going to have a lot of mistakes. Is realizing a mistake quickly, and then acting on it, and I really think it's tremendously important. One of the other big mistakes we made was with a guy named Crazy Eddie. Now you all may be too young to have ever heard of Crazy Eddie, but Crazy Eddie had these advertisements, and every advertisement went up, "Our prices are insane." And he was advertising on TV every night. And I thought we should do due diligence. So I went by to see Crazy Eddie one night, and he arranged to meet at his favorite restaurant. So we went there, and for some reason, We had a a doctor working with us. He was finding medical situations that we would invest in. And so I took him with us. I don't know why I took him on this thing. And crazy Eddie. Now, this is an era when, you know, being in a, not in a coat and tie was unheard of. Crazy Eddie arrived us in an all-black outfit, kind of a fleece suit, a warm-up suit, with a huge medallion coming down. Yeah. And we sat down to dinner. And we asked questions about his family and all this, and he really had almost no life except work. And he didn't go to baseball games with his kids or anything, but he loved his children. There was no question about that. So I thought, you know, this is wonderful. We've found a workaholic, and we can't go wrong in this thing. And so we invested in Crazy Eddie, and unfortunately, he really was crazy. And the next thing we knew, he was found somewhere in the Middle East, absconded with stockholders' funds. But you do make a lot of mistakes in this business, and you should go into it knowing that, and you should go into it realizing you're going to make mistakes and trying to minimize them as much as possible.
I had one more question. I'm sure we're all wondering what your outlook is for equities, kind of considering what the VIX is at and, you know, the commodities and whatnot. So, you know, do you have a viewpoint on that, or do you stick more to your, you know, stock picking prowess and doing it that way?
Well, I this will probably put a negative thrust on the evening, but I really feel that there are so many parts of there are so many weaknesses right now in the economic system around the world that I'm extremely worried about things. And it seems to me that we have been extremely fortunate in New York not to have an incident of terrorism. And yet, I don't think the attitudes of people are any better than they have been. Then I think the American consumer is just deeply in debt. There are people actually living in refinance homes. I mean, on refinancing their homes year after year after year. And a lot of young people really don't realize the negative aspect of borrowing money. And that makes us, I think, vulnerable. And it really worries me. And then you look at the Chinese miracle, and it really is a miracle. I mean, to see what's accomplished over there in the last, you know, 30 or so years, and it just keeps exploding in growth. You realize that the state-owned banks lend money to state-owned industrial companies, and neither the bank nor the borrower ever expect to see that money again. And what happens to that money? I mean, somebody's got to be left holding the bag somewhere. And that worries me. And then, of course, we right now are in the beginning stages of a very serious housing decline, which, if it's escalated, could bring on great problems. So I think this is one of the times where you have to be extremely conservative. And as I say that, the market goes up every day. And the worst shorts, in other words, the shorts that are going the most against those of us in the hedge fund business, are companies that we almost are sure will be bankruptcies within the next 2 or 3 years. But they know that in the meantime, prudent people, prudent hedge fund people, will cover those shorts when they get to a certain level, and they have to. And so those are really the worst things. That's not a good sign, though, for the long term. Sorry for the little... But at least you all are too polite to go to sleep, which is I've had before. Yes, sir.
I just have two quick questions. First is motivation. What really has motivated you or currently motivates you, and what aspect of your faith does that play any role in your motivation? And secondly, if you could talk a little bit about calling, just when you realized personally for yourself that you wanted to manage money, and a lot of the young guys out here probably want to run their own fund someday. If you could, you know, what are some good questions to ask yourself if you want to run money someday?
Okay. Well, I think I wish I had started. I didn't start until I was in the late 40s, really running my own hedge fund. And I really wish I had started earlier. I really think you begin to deteriorate about the time I started the hedge fund. So I think the lucky thing for me was I hired smart young people who were probably overwhelmed with my age. But you ask a lot more questions than that.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to hear a little bit about motivation, maybe something that really drives you or has driven you. And whether
I've really enjoyed this business. It's been a lot of fun for me, and I've loved being in it. And the people I've worked with have motivated me. Have motivated me tremendously. And that's been one of really life's extras, working with the people I have.
I'm sure you've heard of I think it's the Keynesian adage that the market can remain irrational longer than one can remain solvent, or one's hedge fund investors will let you remain solvent. I'm curious, when you think about us as investors, how would you advise us if we're in that kind of situation where we have a position that, let's just say, runs against us and we think that the market is wrong? We think our position is right, but we're getting margin calls. How would you kind of critically think about making a decision in that kind of environment?
Well, in the first place, I hope not to have margin calls. And when you get a margin call, you damn well have got to answer it. But as far as I think if you've got a position and you've done the research and everything is going right, and you're convinced the valuation is right, it's like a car that goes on sale. I mean, if you want it, get it. I mean, that's what you hope for. I hate these people that say, don't you know the market is telling you something? The market's never spoken to me in the 60 years I've been, you know, trading stocks. It never has. And I think you have to make your own analysis, and the ideal scenario is for the thing to be going down, for you to have buying power, and not be getting the margin call, and go in and buy more. I think you go right ahead and buy it and load up on it.
I just one related question. What about if my investors start losing patience, and they think I'm either losing my talent for investing, or I'm going a little nutty because I think I'm always right and everyone else is convinced that I'm wrong? How do you work around that situation?
Well, I think, you know, the best way to work around it is to have a great long-term record. And then I think it's a good idea to really get to know your investors. And that sort of stimulated me on something. We, for instance, used to have a one-day with our investors each year, and we'd put on a program for them during the day and have a big party at night. And we spent a lot of money and work on that. And I think people get to know you that way. And I think that's something, I think that's money well spent.
This is a related question on calling. So as a Christian person, how important is it for what one does for a living to be driven by a sense of Christian calling? And in what sense can money management be viewed as a calling?
I've never thought of it as a calling. I think of it as a gift and something that I should be very appreciative of getting, but I've never felt as a calling. I mean, I think people, again, this is something that's very personal with people. I myself think that people are called into the ministry. I'm in this business because I love it, and I didn't feel called.
It's great to have you. Thank you for being here. Going back to philanthropy for a minute, I actually work for the Morgan Stanley Foundation. I have colleagues who went on to work for the Tiger Foundation. And I was wondering, the big buzzword in our industry is corporate social responsibility. I was wondering what role you think corporations have in giving back to society, whether it's something they should be engaging in because it's the right thing to do, or if it's something, it's not their business, they should stay away from. I was just curious if you had thought on that.
You mean corporations?
Corporations or institutions, companies in general.
Well, I hate to go back to this theme. I mean, there are people who think that corporations should return everything to shareholders, mm-hmm. and that they shouldn't take on corporate responsibilities, social responsibilities. And those people that object to that particularly point out that maybe somebody makes a $200,000 gift to a particular charity so their chief executive's wife can be head of the big benefit that that particular group is having. That's just something I wouldn't... I think it's kind of, again, up to the particular corporation. I can understand both. I think these are personal things that people have to answer themselves. I don't think, I think corporate social responsibility in many ways is good business, though, mm-hmm. also.
Okay.
I mean, you don't want to be a bad citizen. You want to be a good citizen. I mean, that helps your business. I think most businesses realize that.
Thank you.
The first half was all optimistic. The back half seems a little darker. Continuing in that vein, you touched a little bit on when you make a mistake, be decisive, deal with it. But what's, flesh that out more, because in our business, we're always wrong, hopefully not always, and we've got a business, but that seems part of the job. What's your thought process when you've done the work and you still get it real wrong? And maybe how do you manage a team when one of your people get it wrong? And how do you manage that?
Well, I think you just have to say, look, forget it, and let's go on with the next idea. And you can drive yourself batty with kind of self-analysis of something that's gone wrong. And I really feel that we all make mistakes. Let's get out of the mistake and get on with the show.
Hi, Mr. Robertson. I'm just curious about the people in your life who have provided you with support or guidance or inspiration. And I was wondering if you had a mentor throughout your career.
Well, my wife has been a terrific influence and anchor when we had trouble times, and everybody does have trouble times, and I know that the only time we had a real bad time at Tiger coincided with a time when she had a terrible cancer. And that was a really very, very tough period of my life. And I think one that would have been a lot easier if she, you know, had been around to, I mean, not she was around, but I mean, even then she was sort of a model of courage and was terrific. And then my sons have given me a lot of help when things got tough, and I'm eternally grateful for those things.
And did you have a mentor who kind of guided you throughout your career?
Probably not really.
Thank you. Just wanted to ask about major influences, mainly on the business side. Just, you know, if you could recommend books or, you know, anything else that was really formative for you, or, you know, even individuals whose investment philosophy was really helpful.
I worked with a man who's now 104 years old, named Albert Gordon at Kidder Peabody. And he was a wonderful human being, had a terrific life, and had such great values. He was so excited when this old bachelor got married, and I'm sure it was more important to him than for me to have brought in the General Motors account for underwriting. General Motors is not a good word to bring now, but I mean, probably. He was a great person. As far as other people, I really learn a lot, have learned a lot, and still learn a lot from the Tiger Cubs. And so if you have access to any of them, I would suggest you listen to them. They're worth listening to.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much to Julian for coming tonight.
Thank you all so much. And thanks for coming. Thanks.